today is October 26th. Show you to the Bible. At the end of last class, I mentioned different stages in history where we would analyze our pursuit of not just the mechanics of the Bible, but how to understand the Bible. What is this pasuk saying? Right? This week's parasha, it says, Vayinaga Hashem es paro al devar Sarai Ashes Avram. Okay. From a pshat standpoint, it's pretty simple to translate this pasuk to figure out what's going on. Well, I assume by now you've 8 to 12 years, you're in Israel, 8 to 12 years of Jewish education, probably everybody knows what the context of this pasuk is, I hope. We're on tape, so I'll save you. Alright. Okay. First thing you do is you work out, remember, philology. What's that? What does that shorish mean?
Touch.
Okay, usually, yeah, that might be in its the depth of its etymology, what it means here. But here it's more like a nega. Nega is an affliction.
Like shomer negia.
Probably in its deepest etymology, something similar. But a nega is actually the term the Torah gives for leprosy. Right? Being a nega is not just that God touched Paro. That's pretty Paro. God did a lot more than just touch Paro. Although if God touches you, I guess that's going to be pretty serious, right? Right? This made the Kriyas Yamsuf happen for God. Anyway, so okay. God afflicted. That's usually how this is translated. Alright? Nigoim gidolim. Alright, Vayinaga Hashem es Paro. God touched, but you will not find any English translation that translates it that way. What is Targum? It means he afflicted him. He gave him a nega. Alright? Why? Huh? Let's finish the pasuk now. This part is a little easier.
Words of sorrow, the wife of Avram.
Does that make sense to you in English?
No. God afflicted Paro because of the words
okay.
of sorrow.
Well, no. Okay, you're mixing it with Ezra and Rashi right now. But yes, this means because of.
But does it mean
al dvar sorai eshes Avram, right?
Can it mean the situation?
On the matter of Sarai is probably the best translation of these words to capture, get this word right now, the mashma'ut of this pasuk. Mashma'ut means, get this down, this is crucial, the verbal meaning of the words. This is a more common terminology we use when we want to figure out what something means, a shorter word that is you're not paying attention. Stay with me, huh? There's a more common word we use in Hebrew to determine what a person means or what a pasuk means. Not what is the mashma'ut of this pasuk, but what is the shot of the pasuk, you know? Okay? These are two different things. I know they're two different things because Rashi often in his parish writes shuto kimashma'o. Shuto kimashma'o. If those are two synonyms meaning the exact same thing, that would be ridiculous. Okay? Okay? It's pretty clear what this pasuk is saying. Paro made a move on Sarah, right? He had her privately, right? When he made a move on her, or maybe even before he made the move on her, right? Okay? Now, as far as he's concerned, he's in that room with a single woman. Agreed? That's what he was told. That's what Avram's telling everybody, right? So as far as Paro is concerned, he's not really doing anything wrong. Adrabah, I'm taking a single woman and I'm making her, giving her private audience with the king. The quite powerful king, right? Right? Men still think they have the right to do these kind of things. Okay, now we're finally getting in trouble for it. Okay? But here, the Torah already gets him in trouble. What's ironic is that the most egregious case of sexual harassment in Sefer Bereishis is a woman on a man. Talking, of course, about
Yosef
and Ishus Potiphar. All right, because Paro, I'm not going to say he's totally innocent here, but Paro makes a move on her, and she says, no, I'm a married woman. Right? The Medrash says, I'm a married woman. He goes, what are you talking about? Well, you didn't say that outside, and the man you were with didn't say that either. So what are you telling me? Why did you even come in here with me then? That's what my husband said. He said we should always, when we're traveling, say we're brother and sister. We're worried what can happen if we're traveling as a couple. Right? Whether that was wise or not, look at other mafarshim. But what in this line might indicate this is what gives you another word called drash, a deeper meaning that makes you read into a text. Right? It's not the simple meaning. Lavshit means to strip away the skin, to strip away the outer meaning. Of course, in order to do so, you're missing everything here, because you're concentrating on that. Because if you want to know what a simple meaning of a pasuk, first you have to start with the mashmaut. What do the words mean? All right? You're never going to get anywhere if you don't know what the words mean. Okay? So, but also, the drash works with extraneous material. Tell me what's absolutely extraneous in this pasuk. Especially by the time you get to this pasuk, you know very well that it's Sarai is Eishes Avram. Why did you have to say that? Just say, God struck or smote or afflicted Paro because of Sarai. I didn't need this repetition. By the time you get to this pasuk, you were told three times that Sarah and Abraham are husband and wife. So, nope. Okay. So why is it there?
Maybe you forgot when they told Paro that they're brother and sister.
Maybe that's what she actually told Paro.
That's the whole point. That's what we just said now, the last 2 minutes, is that she told Paro, I am Ashes Abraham. And he said, no, you're not. I mean, you agreed to come into this room with me. You didn't come in here kicking and screaming. Right? What's going on? What are you changing your mind now? He says, well... So she started to explain. And then Paro didn't accept it. Now, what I'm telling you now is drash. This is not what's in the pasuk, right? So Rashi writes the following.
She's not talking to Paro.
You see, Drash doesn't need something that's explicit in the pasuk. All drash needs to make a drash, right? But sometimes a drash is based on something that's not in the pasuk at all, right? It's just a tradition that this is the case. But this drash is definitely based on the fact that I have an extraneous Eishes Avram here. I didn't need it, right? Drash darshens the extraordinary, the extra, the superfluous. Why is it there? I didn't need it. But you said al-davar means because of, right? Right? You know the phrase in English, an idiomatic phrase. Right? An idiomatic phrase is what each culture comes up with. Right? If you would try to translate it into another language, it wouldn't make sense in that language. Right? Say, make no bones about it. There are books that tell you, how did that become a phrase to begin with? Right? To be in the limelight. What does that even mean? Right? You mean a lime, mean a fruit? A lime, a substance? What does it mean? Where did it come from? Right? So there are books that give you hundreds of thousands of these in all languages of where these idioms come from. This is an idiom, because if this means because of, can you give me a few better biblical Hebrew words than that to use there?
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say Ve'enegashem is Paro Kisar, maybe, but it would be very rare. It's like a pasuk in Yeshayahu that seems to do that. Better words than that. What? Gesund. What? Use a biblical Hebrew word. There are four or five of them. Ve'enegashem et Paro.
Okay.
For the sake of, what would you? Bishvil Sarai Eshes Avram, Ba'avur Sarai Eshes Avram, Odot Sarai Eshes Avram. You get the point? Right? Biglau Eshes Sarai Eshes Avram. Those are four simpler biblical words to use than Alvar Sarai Eshes Avram. So let's construct a drash. Why does the Torah use an idiom when a much easier word, that the assumption of drash is, maybe you've studied philosophy, Occam's razor, you ever hear of that?
The simplest explanation.
The simplest explanation is always the best one. Fewer words, the better. That's the way Rashi, that's the Chazal approach biblical texts. If there's anything extra than I needed, if you gave me too much information, or even more information than I needed, I'm going to do something with it. Okay? So what? Let's create a drash right here. Vayenagah Hashem is paro al dvar. Don't read it idiomatically. Read it mashmautli.
Maybe you put a comma after Sarai, so you say like on the words of Sarai, Eshes Avram.
Right. That's what Rashi does on the pasuk. It's not the pshat. It says that when Paro made his move on Sarai, she said, "God, don't let him do this." And then Paro got a little whammy. And she said, "God, hit him again." Until three or four times when he got the picture. Whoa, this woman is something. Okay, go back to your brother. Go ahead. Avram is technically not lying when she says she's my sister. Sarah and Lot are brother and sister, by the way. Lot has a sister named Yiska, which in Aramaic means princess, which in Hebrew means Sarah. All right? They're from Aram. Okay, when Chazal say that, Yiska is Sarah. All right? So Avram calls Lot my brother all over the parsha. So he can call Lot's sister. It was very common to marry a niece in the ancient world. Nahor also did. Nahor married Haran's other daughter named Milcah. All right? You call your nephew brother all the time. That's it. Your brother's son you call brother too. He calls him brother in this parsha. So he can call Sarah sister. Anyway, point is that this is how drash works. Right? So that's what we're doing for the rest of the semester. How do we understand and work with the intricate, detailed, elaborate, extraneous usage of the Hebrew language in the Torah? Rashi expresses his derech without writing an introduction in the very first word in the Torah, Bereishis bara Elokim. Rashi gives a huge drash on this word. I don't want to put you on the spot again. Would anyone venture to please translate this word?
In the beginning, or is it a person, or like a thing? Like, Bereishit bara Elohim, like, so created, or something.
Okay. You want to just say, give me the words that it means in English.
In the beginning.
It's not. That's not what this word means. Bereishonam means in the beginning. I'll tell you, the word only appears three times in the entire Tanakh, right? And the other two times are one parak after another in Sefer Yirmiyahu. Can you translate this? This is where it appears in Yirmiyahu Chav Zayin. Bereishis Mamlechet Yehoyakim. Translate those words for me, please.
Beginning the control of
what? Bereishis in the beginning. What?
The queen? Malka?
What's that? Mamlacha?
Kingdom.
Kingdom, okay.
Kingdom.
In the beginning of the kingdom, or the reign, if you will, might be a better translation of Yehoyakim. Alright? You want to say that whole pasuk again?
In the beginning of the kingdom.
Okay, now translate the word gracious for me. You have to go to your high school principal and ask your money back. You just said it. In the beginning of. Bereishis is a construct. It belongs to the word after it. Bereishonah stands alone. Bereishis doesn't. So why does the Torah use the word Bereishis? You all got it when you translated the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, in the beginning of. That's what Bereishis means. So why is the Torah using an unusual word? The first word Rashi tells, you know what Rashi writes? Bereshis, this is his first perush. He says that I looked through the Bible to see what is called Rashis. He found there are lots of things called Rashis. Truma is called Rashis. Right? But Rashi found two words he liked that means Rashis. Torah in Mishlei and Bnei Yisrael in Yirmiyahu. So Rashi says, you think that Rashi wants to pull the wool over our eyes? This is really what this word means? He says, bishvil, for the sake of Rashis, Bnei Yisrael, keeping Torah, did God create heaven and earth? Now, that's not, Rashi doesn't think that that's the pshat of this pasuk. Of course not. Rashi then afterwards says, come on, there's a word missing in this pasuk. Can you put one a word in English in this pasuk? I believe that the Art Scrolls Chumash translates the pasuk that way. In English, don't do it in Hebrew, I'm not going to challenge you that much. Give me a word in English. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth, to make sense of that as a construct. Yeah, it says it. The English translation. Want to skip an English word, please?
Instead of in the beginning?
Yes, now in the beginning of. He did Rashi's interpretation. In the beginning of God's creating the heavens and earth.
Start of creation, or
that's good too. Rashi writes means tchilat bero Elokim, in the beginning of God's creating heaven and earth. But if you translate this in the beginning, God created heaven and earth, you are making a mistake, because that would be barishona bero Elokim. You can say, what difference does it make? Commentaries wanted to be very precise with why the Torah uses this word and not another word. Why Al-Dvar and not one of those? Okay? That is what faced our commentaries when they want to figure out what does the Bible mean. Okay? Good? We're all good? Question?
What's the difference between Mashmaut and Pshat?
Okay, so I'm going to... it's a good question. I usually would reserve it for a little later in this discussion, but let's deal with it now. Okay, mashma'ut is just the verbal meaning of the words. Pshat is, what do you mean by those words? Those are not always the same. Okay, I'll give you some examples of where the Torah does this. The Torah says, V'batzar es ha-shamayim v'lo yihye matar. All right, the bottom line is much easier to translate than the top line, because matar is definable. It means rain. There will not be any rain. The Atzaras HaShamayim is a little more difficult to wrap your fingers around. What does it mean, I will stop up the heavens? Now, without the B phrase, I will stop up the heavens, I assure everyone in the world will explain. Yeah. It won't rain. Won't be any rain, right? So the mashma'ut of I will stop up the heavens, I mean, what do you mean by that? That can mean a lot of things, but most rational people will hear that and say, there won't be any rain. It's a poetic way of saying there won't be any rain. What's the problem with that interpretation? It says it right afterwards. Why do you have to tell me the same thing twice? You follow? So the answer that Rashbam, Ibn Ezra, Radak, most of the Sephardic commentaries, Rashbam is definitely Ashkenazic, but the answer given to that is, come on, the Torah is poetic. The Torah sometimes repeats with no reason at all but to be poetic. Yeah, well, if you approach the Torah from the standpoint of Occam's razor, that's not going to do it for you. You got it? And the ones who approach the Bible that way are generally the Gemara. Right? The Gemara does not like you just repeat two phrases, one after the other, saying exactly the same thing, right? And Rashi. Rashi is the king of Occam's razor approach to the Bible. That's what made him so popular. It's everything, and he squeezes everything out of the text. There's a Tana who reads who the Gemara often calls the reader like this, is Rabbi Akiva. Right? He's the one that God brags at Har Sinai to Moshe. Wait till you see someone, Rabbi Akiva, who darshans every single extra word. Moshe himself didn't appreciate what that meant at the time. Malchus Dachartes. He actually analyzes Gemara later in the semester. Right? Okay, so that's what made Rabbi Akiva so popular vis-a-vis the other students. Right? Daf Yomi a few weeks ago said that all the students flocked to Rabbi Akiva, so that all of the Stam Mishnah, Rabbi Meir, Stam Tosefta, Rabbi Nechemiah, Stam Sifra, Rabbi Yehuda, Stam Sifra, Rabbi Shimon, Kuli Alibid, Rabbi Akiva. And they all flocked away from Rabbi Yishmael, who you look is so rigorous in Shas about his approach to the biblical text. Akiva is much more, I use this term liberal in his in allowing more drash to take place. Get it? But since you asked more, I want to say this, there's an excellent example, two examples I'd like to use to demonstrate the difference between pshat and mashmaut. I think humor is the best example of this. Or perhaps advertisement. Advertisement relies, right, an advertisement for products, it relies on a pshat and a mashmaut to get 2 points across. I remember taking a marketing class here at YU 35 years ago and gave an example of a current vodka ad that says, he brings in the ad, he shows, this vodka will leave you breathless. Now, what's your first pshat that you think the ad means when it says breathless?
No, really. Amazed.
Dead? Really. I don't think so.
Amazed.
I can't catch my breath, this vodka is so good. I've never tasted anything like this. Right? Didn't you say that that's the pshat, right, of the word breathless? Okay, now breathless can mean a lot of different things, but then he shows, and he brings an article, and now you can probably Google it in a second, but vodka is different than all alcoholic drinks in the following way. If it's really good, you could drink a whole bottle of it, right, and breathe on a person, and that person doesn't know you just drank. Scotch, wine, that they could tell after a drink or two that you drink, you stink. Right? But good vodka, you get it, leaves you breathless. Now the ad means something totally different. Following? It's a drash. You have to be well suited for drash. Drash doesn't hit you right away. Pshat hits you right away. Right? You get it? The pshat of Al Dvar Sareishis Avram is no doubt. Paro, God smote Paro on the matter of, if you wanted to hit the mashmaut, the best. In English, you'd probably say, God smote Paro because of Sarai and Shazafra. Got it? Like you said before. If you wanted it, some translators like to translate, the new JPS, Jewish Publication Society, likes to translate the psukim as close to the meaning of the Hebrew words as possible, unless you just can't. Right? Some instances. Okay, phone. Right. It says, "V'haya habachor asher teleid yakum al shem ochiv hames." What mitzvah are we talking about right here?
Yibum.
All right. Bachor that she gives birth to yakum al shem. You know what that means, right? Name the child after his. Problem is, he's named after his uncle, not after his brother. But the Gemara in Yevamos says that this doesn't mean it by the name, but it's an idiom, meaning instead of. Okay? See, in Hebrew, Al Shem, it doesn't just mean by the name of. Can also be an idiomatic phrase. If you speak Hebrew, you'll get it, right? Get it? Okay. All right. So that is the difference between pshat and I think humor also, right? Is right? A man walks into a bar and says, "Ow, ow, ow." Okay. Okay. Then I'm just. This mushroom walks into a bar and says, "I'd like a drink, please." He goes, "We don't serve people like you." He goes, "Why not? I'm a fun guy." So
question on the A and B
it's hard to show. I don't, like, the Talmud, I don't know, why are we taking that to mean the rain will stop?
It doesn't. The Gemara concludes that it means there won't be wind. Rain needs wind. That comes from up there also. I'll stop the heavens from wind. I'll stop it from clouds. You need clouds to protect the vegetation from the heat of the sun at midday.
What are they translating Shemayim as? The physical sky?
Sky will be closed up from things it usually produces that are good for you. Now that is usually means rain. But since the end of the pasuk says it means rain, the Gemara wants the beginning of the pasuk to say it means some other things that come up from up there. You get it? That's Rashi. That's the Gemara Tainus.
Does Shemayim usually mean like physical sky in other contexts? Is it usually something more?
Very good. Very interesting. By the mun, there are some, I found one or two perushim that said, I'm giving you lechem min hashamayim. In form from the heaven, lechem min hashamayim, the benes min hashamayim. Have you heard that?
Yeah.
Min hashamayim means from God.
You're
really doubting now. The whole point of this whole section in the second parasha of Kriyat Shema is that you're not going to get the rain you need for your Sapta Diganetal, so Chug is Rabbi. Okay. Alright, so, but I think it's a decent drash. Probably belongs in a Hasidic Tish. Which is certainly legitimate. Okay? Alright, so this is now, I said, we turn the corner to the second part of the semester about how do we interpret this often enigmatic, and I mean, it guides our lives. How are we interpreting this?
I just have a question about the Rashi on Tereshi. When you said it's Bishvil Tereshi, is how we interpret it? Is that a drash?
Yes, absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
Then
afterwards he gives up shot.
The shot is just the S. Beginning of would be the shot.
Yes, afterwards he does something called Derech Katsar. Have you heard this? Derech Katsar means there's something that you need to put into the pasuk that's not there in order to make sense of the pasuk. Didn't we do that last class? What word? Do you remember? It's something in this week's parsha. Did you notice?
Mirev.
Right. The nas, the lo nasa ha'aretz. Aretz is feminine. Nasa should have been nasa with a hey at the end. Right? So Rashi doesn't want a pasuk to be inconsistent. It starts off masculine, it goes to feminine. So Rashi says, okay, derech katsar. There's something not in the pasuk that needs to be there. That's perfectly fine. The Gemara Pesachim says that's a perfectly legitimate way to read biblical text. Okay.
So what's the basic meaning of Rashi? The mashmaim.
So, in the beginning of, now insert a word that's not there. So Rashi writes one Hebrew word, bero, which that English translation perfectly translated. In the beginning of God's creation, of heaven and earth, pasuk bet now, if you choose to read the pasuk, b'derech katsar, that's Rashi's pshat, right? I think that Rashi gave the drash first. There's a whole lot of Torah when Rashi gives the drash first, and then the pshat first, and then the drash. Why give the drash at all? Because Rashi wants his readers to know that the Bible speaks on multiple levels. Right? When the Torah, when the Gemara says "Ein mikra yotzei midei pshuta," right, which only appears three times in the whole 5,422 pages of pshats. Right. When the Torah, and by the way, commenting, all right, when I wrote this pasuk here about Al Shem Achiv Hameis, that's one of them. When the Gemara said that it means rather than by the name of, that's one of the three places where the Gemara says, how can you make such a drash? Ain't me kriyot sim adip shuto. Right? You've heard of the phraseology, right? Rashi uses it often. It doesn't mean ain't me kriyot ela kipshuto, that the only way to read the biblical text is pshat. Means don't forget the pshat. Following? Now, we often say, ever hear of Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, this way is right, that way is right, Yochasid Shatorah is right, this is right, this, right? It's fine. It's perfectly okay. Right? We can live side by side. Pshat and the drash, just like in humor, just like in the advertising. Right? Okay? All right, so It would be crazy to think that this vodka ad was taken out for people who are suicidal, right? What breathless may also mean. And sometimes you have to say that's an illegitimate meaning of that word. It's just wrong. I don't usually like to say that about a pasuk. If you, with good intention, think that that's what the pasuk is saying, as long as you're approaching it, you know, l'shem shemayim, and you basically have the proper, you know, grammar, context, philology. We talked about the rules before pshat. But even if you want to go beyond that, okay. But there are obviously some illegitimate ways to read the text. You just have to get good teaching and good rules about what's better and what's not. Okay. So now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the different time periods where we'll be studying for the rest of the semester. I wrote them on the board at the end of the last class, right? I want you to be aware of this concept, the Tanakh itself, all right? That's obvious. There are passages in Zechariah that help make sense of cryptic passages in Yirmiyahu. Right? There are passages in Yehoshua that make important interpretations of cryptic psukim in the Torah. Right? This is especially meaningful, this number one, when because it, you know, I'm trying to teach you how to read the Bible, but when I'm teaching how to read the Bible, it's also crucial to know how not to read the Bible. Okay? This was a split down the Jewish community, probably from the time the Torah was given until well into the Middle Ages, and it's just an amazing historical phenomenon that the group of people that read the Torah this way have just disappeared. They were so powerful in the Middle Ages. The year 1000, they were politically powerful with the Muslims. Even the Christians were equal opportunity killers. And the Nazis pushed them together with the Jews. My father lived in a city with quite a large community. I'm talking about Karaites. You heard of them, right? The Tzedukim, Karaites, the Dead Sea Scrolls, Mistama, were people of this ilk. The Ethiopians who were taken out, they did not have a Torah Shabbat path. I'm talking about people who read the Bible without any tradition. They only read it with a straight shot of the Bible. Okay? So you know what? You're going to eat on Yom Kippur. You know why? Torah just says afflict yourselves in Yom Kippur. It doesn't say don't eat. We have an oral tradition that says, how do you afflict yourselves? B'sheva al taseh, by refraining from doing something. Karaites bloody themselves on Yom Kippur. They stand until they physically drop. Sometime the next day. They don't sleep. Right? They physically exhaust themselves. And you know what? Everybody has their own way. I can't tell whether what afflicts you is not what afflicts me. Right? That's a little crazy. They don't have a Talmud. By the way, Karaites do have law codes. Some of the law codes have begun to read like Talmuds. I've studied them here in graduate school. 2 years I spent Karaite parshanut and interpretation. I'm extremely curious about their interpretation, not just their halachic works, but their interpretation, because it's pure pshat, right? So when the Torah says, start counting 49 days, mimocharas, anyone know the next word in the Torah? Hashavas, right? Karaite Shavuos is always on Sunday, every year. It's fascinating that their Pesach is always on Thursday. Karaites have manipulated the calendar for Pesach to always fall Wednesday night, and for Shavuos to always be on Friday, on a Saturday. Okay. And they don't start counting the Omer the day after the first day of Pesach. They wait till the Saturday night, and then they start counting that night. Torah says, "Mimacharas HaShabbos." Okay. Yahushua chapter 5. I'm sure this is why it was chosen as the Torah, the first day of Pesach. Says they came into the land, crossed over the Yarden, and in Yahushua Parakeh it says, Mimochoros HaPesach. Doesn't say they counted 49 days. It says they started eating from the new grain. Now that's what the counting is. You can't eat the new grain until the second day of Pesach. Until whatever Mimacharas HaShabbos means. But in Yahushua, it means Mimacharas HaPesach. The counting of the Omer is from bringing an Omer of barley to bringing two Shtei HaLechem of wheat between Pesach and Shavuos. Right? And you're counting 49 days in between. Yahushua Perakei sheds light on the, let's say, nebulous meaning of why does the Torah use the word Shabbos to define Pesach? A beautiful explanation is given in the Mefarshim and Ibn Gemara. Why refer to Pesach of all holidays as a Shabbos? Shavuos and Sukkot aren't called Shabbos. Why are you calling Pesach Shabbos? So this just came into my head. I never heard this one before. It just came into my head. Why should Pesach be more Shabbos than Sukkot and Shavuos? Because what did Pesach do for us? New, so now connect that to Shabbos for us right now. Oh, come on, guys.
Rest
okay, it gave us a rest from servitude. That's a Shabbos. You get it? More Shabbos than Sukkot and Shavuos historically. Right? Some really beautiful interpretations of why Pesach is called a Shabbos. What I just did in my head shows that the Torah is so amazing, the Chidushim waiting to be, that in your head waiting to be said that no one ever said before. Someone probably said this. Right? My grandfather wrote hundreds of thousands, he lived to past 90, he left hundreds of thousands of papers, literally, boxes and boxes of his own personal writings, and most of them he shared with his son who lived upstate. And someone once asked him, why don't you put this together, right? So he goes, whatever I wrote, if it's good, someone said it already. And if it's not good, no one should be reading it. Right? So now one of my cousins got a hold of all this, one of got a hold of all these pages, and they're putting out every year. It's called Divrei Moshe. Big black sparring of one or two of his sparring every year. Bang, bang, just putting it out. So your minds are waiting to mechadesh, right? The Karaite has the right to ask, if I'm wrong about when to celebrate Shavuos, why does the Torah write Mimacharas or Shabbos? Right? So the answer is, in a lot of these cases, the Tanakh itself will answer. Got it? Okay. I'm just giving one example. There are hundreds. Okay. You just have to know how to use the Tanakh. My purpose in this course is not to give you many examples of this, but to tell you that that's there. Right? Okay. I contend you will not fully do justice to Yirmiyahu unless you also learn parts of Zechariah. And Daniel, for that matter. And if you really want to get it, you need to know the whole Tanakh to understand every single other book. How about that? Okay? If you really want to get, you know. All right. The next thing. 2. Ancient Near East. Which is what I gave you here. It says, Tanakh in light of archaeological discovery. Right? Stands to reason that after 3,500 years, a lot of changes, right? There's a lot of differences between the way our ancestors approach things and the way we do, right? Torah's not given in a vacuum, right? This now, I hope you can start to feel it. I actually hinted at it before. Might be a significant difference between the way Orthodox Jews read this material and the way Reform and Conservative may read it. When Reform and Conservative, let's just keep it safe and say Reform, because Conservative is supposed to be right near Orthodox on these things. Lamaisa, they're not, but they're supposed to be. So I'm not going to keep Conservative out of this. But the Reform movement said 150 years ago or more, we don't need to separate milk and meat anymore. We admit that there was once an issue of separation of milk and meat, right? But we don't need to do it anymore. The whole reason why they separated milk and meat had to do with ancient rituals that even the Rambam talked about, right? So that's the first thing we're talking about on this page. See, it says, Bishul Basar B'Cholav, right? So the Torah just very strangely puts the mitzvah of not eating milk and meat right alongside the mitzvah of bringing first fruits to the Beis HaMikdash. Reishis b'kureyat masachot tavi beis Hashem alokecha lo sebashel zibach alokecha. Bring your first fruits to the temple. Don't cook milk and meat together. So good commentaries try to figure what do these two have to do with the other. So until I saw what this collection of the Rambam's interpretations and some other studies on this topic, those studies are down towards the middle of this page. To me, the best interpretation of connecting these two was in the Karaite literature. You see, and then I found it in the parish of Rabbi Yehuda Chassid. It's the most amazing thing. Rabbi Yehuda Chassid was a 12th century German commentary who headed a movement called Hasidei Ashkenaz. They were extremely pietistic. They suffered tremendously under Christendom and the Crusades. And their people were profoundly, profoundly from. They fasted 2 days of Yom Kippur because they lived outside of Israel. They could keep 2 days of Shavuos, they should keep 2 days of Yom Kippur. Right? So anyway, I found this in the parish of the Chassid, is that Reishis b'kureyat masachot tavi beis Hashem alokecha, right? Lo sevashel dibach alevimo, that the last few words of this pasuk, besides the mitzvah, the chassid says, besides the mitzvah, bas v'cholo, has a hint to bikur. And he says, imo means mother earth. Lo sevashel means don't ripen. Gedi, he shows from a pasuk that says, that refers to the earth as a fruit as a goat, and bachalev means based on the strength of the mother earth. Basically, what it means, don't allow the fruit to ripen on the tree and become so heavy that it falls to the earth. Pick it and give it as bikurim before it falls to the ground. Get it? It's about bishul peiros. You're familiar with that terminology? It means to ripen.
They translated goat as a fruit.
Yeah, lo sevasha. Don't let the fruit ripen on the tree and fall to Mother Earth, because all fruits will fall to the ground, except the esrog, by the way. All fruits get too heavy, and it's going to fall to the ground at some point. Right? The tree gets weaker and it can't hold on to this such a heavy thing. Look at any apple tree and when apples get too big. So the Karaites understand the whole pasuk to refer to a rule about Bikurim, and Karaites eat milk and meat together. They don't have a rule of milk and meat. Okay? So but we know that this teaches us, we have a Torah Shabbat Pet, it's all parak in the second, that says that this pasuk teaches to avoid cooking milk and meat, and to avoid eating them, and to have any benefit from them. Okay, so these studies down here refer to the following. I'm just going to conclude with this. That in Ugarit, Ugarit is a nation just to the north of Israel with a language that's very close to Hebrew. Right? And they were pagan culture. They had rituals involving cooking milk and meat. Right? The Rambam refers to two other nations, Sabians and Nabataeans, who would cook milk and meat to show dominance over life and death. The milk is a motif of life, the meat is a motif of death, and we can bend those powers to our will with this ritual. Right? These cultures, these nations, believe that their gods can be coerced, forced into my will by these rituals. That's why they perform so much magic. Right? Look, we're not too far from that. We believe in something called Tzadik Gozer Vashem Kayeh. We try to force God and coerce God into what we want, what we need, what we want, with our prayers and with our mitzvahs and the masitzolim, right? Don't we say that too? They say it's an automatic, and if it doesn't happen, it's because we didn't do it right. And then they would take this milk and meat residue and pour it over a swatch of holy crops to assure that everything, all their other crops will succeed. Given that, it makes sense now for the Torah to say, bring your first fruits back to the Mikdash and give it to the Kohen. What will that do for you? That will make the crops succeed. What shouldn't you do to make your crops succeed? Don't do those ridiculous rituals. Those things are stupid. God warns us, generally speaking, stay away from the magical workings of the nations. They're irrational. They don't make sense. They don't move me in any way. What moves me is your Masim Tovim and your morality, not ridiculous rituals. All right? Now, I don't mean to. I have to be careful how I am critical of that, because we have rituals too. How does wearing, putting these batim into my tefillin, and how does shaking a lemon and it looks like a lemon and these branches, how does that do anything? Right. So we have our rituals too, and we understand. We try to give meaning to them, right? By learning Sefer Achinuch and Rambam and Gemara Bukhin. Some people just say, oh, God, you tell me to do this, I'm doing it. Right? We have our rituals too. We have our Gemaras that explain that when you shake the lulav, it makes the winds go properly and spread the seeds, and the next year we'll have a great harvest. Right? It's not so different than what the pagans are doing. Yeah, the difference is this was told to us by God, and that was told to us by that. That's what the pagans do. But God's going to tell us what works and what doesn't. Right? We up front. We do plenty of things like this, and it's the Torah is the arbiter. What works and what doesn't? Cooking milk and meat doesn't work. Shaking wool and esrog does. Giving bikurim does. Bring bikurim to the Kohen, I'll make the crop successful. Don't cook milk and meat. Don't do those ridiculous things. They don't have it. They don't. It doesn't do anything. So don't waste your time on what doesn't work. Yes.
So the explanation that bikurim is like milk and meat, and that the fruit
connection between bikurim and
the fruit is the kid and the earth is the mother.
Well, that was they said the carrot.
So that's not. But I thought you said Rabbi Yehuda.
And then I found it in his parish, which is you should never be so surprised by what you find in his parish. But yeah, I found it in one rabbinic commentary. But I assure you, Rabbi Yehuda Fosid did not eat milk and meat.
Okay.
He just says this is another interpretation. Kara, I'd say, this is the interpretation. They don't have a law of avoiding milk and meat. I use this as when students I have who are in Hebrew school, why do we have to keep an oral tradition? The Torah was given to us, and that's enough. What do I know? So I say, look, those who did not have an oral tradition, the Tzedukim, the Dead Sea Scrolls, people who hid away in the caves, the Qumran sects, the Karaites, they have dropped out. Once you think the Torah is important, there's no way to read the Torah but with a totally oral tradition. We call Torah Shabbat. It's the Mishnah interpreted by the Gemara, interpreted by the Rishonim, and put down into codes in the Middle Ages. If you don't have that, you, Judaism, will not survive. And history shows it. Right? Okay, so that, please, to take this, what you have is, go through. Just, I want you to be familiar. I'm going to ask for readers next place. Familiar with B. See, B, vicarious punishment. Look up in the dictionary what that means if you have trouble with it. Lex talionis, E. Look that up too if you're not sure what that means. But when you read the psukim, you will see. When we do E, we'll talk about abortion and the difference between the Catholic Church and Judaism. And then, when it's Tameh HaMitzvot, look at A. Okay. I'm going to ask you to look up that book of Kretz, but just be familiar with that. And then we're going to do C, which is Ov Vid Onida. Be familiar with those psukim about Ov Vid Onida. That's calling back the dead That's on page 43. It's taken out of your Chuberet that's online. Okay? Be familiar with this for next class. That's what we will be doing. Okay, guys, have a great day. Good Shabbos.
Thank you, Rabbi.